From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deck. And most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. No, several of us have been to the UK, right?
Correct.
Right? Have we all been?
I have when I was very, very little, but I don't really recall it intimately.
Okay. And Paul, thumbs up, thumbs down. Have you been to London? He has not. Okay, Paul, we will go on an adventure soon, assuming we can get into the country after today's episode, which is kind of a question that we have to confront often.
I think we'll be fine as we will find out a little bit later.
Yes.
About the differences in MIs.
Hopefully, yes. Hopefully we will be fine. You know, if the Epstein episode didn't didn't finish us, hopefully this one will be fine. So we have a lot of listeners in the United Kingdom. A lot of your fellow listeners, as you are checking out the show today, are located often in the Anglosphere, where people speak English, right? But there are listeners around the world. We just got an email from a guy in Uganda, actually, which is very interesting.
He was slapped our wrists.
Was not a fan of the Above Majestic interview. By the way, you can check out our Facebook page. Here's where it gets crazy to see our response to this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a episode that will center on the United Kingdom. If you are thinking to yourself, Matt, Noel, Ben, Mission Control, why should I care about this? Why does it matter to me? I don't want to go to foggy London town. This is irrelevant.
Well, let's just say before you get into your point, remember all the connections we've made between intelligence agencies across the world, especially those that speak English.
Right, right. So this matters to you. If you can understand the language in which we are conducting this podcast, then this matters very much, more so than you might assume. Like most countries, the United Kingdom has its own variety of intelligence services. And most people outside of the UK, we're familiar with their intelligence operations through one very important portrayal in fiction, James Bond.
Yes.
Right? Da-da-da-da. Yes, perfect. Agent 007 himself. I mean, I can't even – I should have looked this up before we hopped in the booth here, but I don't even remember how many James Bond films exist.
I'm going to have a shot in the dark and say 12.
That sounds like the title for a James Bond film.
A Shot in the Dark.
but that's not right.
It's more than 12.
15?
Paul says 35. Paul 25. Says 19. Paul says, yeah,
25.
He said 25.
That's amazing. And it also shows, like, of course, we would be most familiar with intelligence agencies through this James Bond thing. There's also an interesting study you can find if you just Google it, about James Bond's drinking habit. Somebody went through all the books and they counted every time he had a drink. And we're like, well, this guy is clearly wasted the entire time and he probably has a cirrhotic liver.
Have you ever had a Vesper martini? That's James Bond's martini of choice.
Yeah, there are a couple great Vesper places here in town now.
Really, really good. Yeah. It's like got a lemon twist and it uses Lillet instead of vermouth, I believe, which is like a kind of dry white wine aperitif kind of thing. Very citrusy, very refreshing.
I have no idea most of the words that you just said.
Aperitif? White wine,
aperitif.
Lillet's the brand. It's good.
It's good. We also have a huge advocate for Vespers in the form of our pal Josh Clark. He's a Vesper guy now.
Nice.
I don't know why I said it like that. That shakes his moral character to the core.
I see a lot of people riding around on the Vespers in Atlanta.
That's cute, Matt. Oof. All right, I like it.
You're welcome.
Big oof. But today we are taking a look behind the curtain, past the sexy James Bond portrayals, right? Today we're looking at the real-life inspiration for countless spy thrillers aiming to answer a disturbing question. Let's just get it out of the way now. Is MI5 a criminal organization?
Ooh, that's heavy.
It's a good way to frame this discussion.
It really is.
Yeah, it absolutely it is.
Oh, get some clicks, right?
Yeah. It's a big question.
Sure.
And we're going to drill down into it, as they say in corporate speak.
Let's start drilling.
Let's get granular. So what is MI5?
Well, MI is the most important thing you need to know here, and that's military intelligence.
I thought it was Mission Impossible.
I wish that it was.
I thought it was Martian intuition.
In this case, it is military intelligence.
All right.
Specifically, that number afterwards is the section number, so Section 5. And it's founded in 1909, and it wasn't called this at all times. It started out as just something that was called the Secret Service Bureau.
Because what better way to keep a secret than have the word secret in the title?
That's right. I mean, in that Secret Service in 1909, you can see it harken back then to the United States in our own Secret Service. And it what we'll find is that they do very different things. And that's why you kind of have sections for all these different secret services that you have. In this case, MI5 is directed by the Joint Intelligence Committee, or JIC. And this service itself is bound by this thing that was created in 1989 called the Security Service Act.
Of 1989.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's in the name, right? What we mean when we say bound is that the Security Service Act essentially, or I should say ostensibly, lays the groundwork for what MI5 is supposed to do, how it does it.
What it can do, basically.
Right. And what does it do? The service is supposed to – well, it's directed to, we should say, protect British parliamentary democracy and Britain's economic interests and a counterterrorism and espionage within the UK. So counterintelligence.
MI5 was founded by Captain Vernon Kell. It's a very distinguished-sounding name. The organization played a central role in the capture of most of Imperial Germany's intelligence agents in the UK at the beginning of World War I. It's a big deal. MI5 is not the same thing, it's important to note, as MI6. MI5 is the British Security Service, while MI6 is the British Foreign Intelligence Service. So, Ben, how should we think about this?
Yeah, think of it as being similar in a way – for our American listeners, to the relationship between the FBI and the CIA.
Which always kind of flummoxed me a little bit, if I'm being honest.
I think it always flummoxed the FBI and CIA themselves.
Ooh.
Because they certainly overstep into one another's territory.
They encroach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, when the CIA is dealing drugs and the FBI has to deal with it, things get messy.
Uh-oh.
Whatever, it's true.
Ultimately, it's dealing with inward-facing and outward-facing counterintelligence and intelligence, right?
Perfect. Yeah, that's the perfect way to say it. Essentially, MI6 is tasked to send British spies abroad, and MI5 is there to catch spies from other countries. So
there you go.
That makes sense, right?
Crystal.
And there are multiple military intelligence services. I really like that you hit on this, Noel, because we a lot of people have kind of this Heinz 57 problem when we talk about MI5 and MI6. You know, were you ever a kid looking at Heinz 57 and wondering where the hell are the other 56?
Yeah, I want to try some of those at least.
Ketchups.
It doesn't have to do with how many spices are in it or something. I don't know. I assumed it was like Baskin-Robbins where they've got the flavors, but then they always exceeded that flavor number. Right?
We should probably ask Lauren Vogelbaum or Annie Reese. There's a plug for Savor, the food science show, lifestyle. But yeah, so it turns out
It was an historical advertising slogan about the 57 different varieties of pickles.
Pickles. Okay. How do you have 57 different – I guess you can pickle anything, right?
Yeah.
So in the case of these multiple military intelligence services in the UK, we find that they go all the way up to MI19, and many have come and gone since the creation of the first military intelligence service, MI1, which was created sometime during World War I, and they mainly focused on cryptography, code breaking, counterintelligence stuff. You know what I mean? So they were figuring out what Imperial Germany was up to, and as we mentioned, they were quite successful with some of this stuff. And over time, various sections folded or they merged or they changed their area of focus. And these sections, MI 1 through 19, ran all sorts of different, I don't want to say hustles, but different processes. Their activities included stuff like specialized geographical analysis. You know, we have a desk that just looks at Russia, for instance, or one that just looks at South America. And then they would have things like map making, aerial photography. They would also have things that we would normally find objectionable in Western governments today, such as three different active propaganda and censorship bureaus.
Yeah.
And they were blatant about it. That's what it said on their label.
But, you know, a lot of that stuff spawned out of World War II when the propaganda had to be strong on all fronts.
Right.
And including with that was MI-19 that you already mentioned, and that was the bureau specifically, or the, I guess, section specifically designed to interrogate prisoners of war during World War II, which is kind of scary. It's like the black site section.
And it's interesting because the organization feels a little bit different in comparison to intelligence agencies in the U.S. Like the CIA handles a ton of this stuff with its own different subsections. You know what I mean? So what does MI5 do? We've looked at just the broad strokes of this. But when we ask what it actually does on the ground, this is one of those $1 million or £1 million questions. Officially, MI5 does what it says on the website, right?
Yeah, it catches spies. That's what it does. It intercepts communications. It finds people. It conducts classified counterintelligence. I mean, come on. That's MI5 for you. And what it does is it keeps the bear from the door.
Or the wolf.
It says that
whatever,
on the website.
Whatever scary animal that you'd like
yeah,
to.
The yeah, the coyotes can't get in because of us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that Cold War reference, right? Because the UK had to reorganize a lot of their stuff and evolve their sophistication when the KGB came out guns blazing in the Cold War. Right?
Oh, this is interesting, though, because to this day, many of these operations, MI5 operations, remain classified.
Yeah.
It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it seems like in our country, some of that stuff kind of eventually over time when it ceases to be important for security, we get to get a little glimpse into, you know, some of the past covert operations, right? A little
yeah,
bit.
Some of them, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you're absolutely correct. One thing that's tough for the British public is that without information about a lot of these operations, many of which were fairly recent in the 1980s and stuff, without that information, it's tough to gauge how successful or unsuccessful this organization is. Because if they're doing everything right, you never hear about them. You know,
that's
only
it.
Hear about them when something goes pear-shaped, which I believe is British slang.
Or something goes really right and another person leaks information.
Right. And that's how we do know of some intelligence failures. For instance, in 1983, one of MI5's officers, a guy named Michael Bettany, was caught trying to sell information to the KGB. And he got caught. He got convicted of espionage. So the big question is, what did he successfully sell some stuff beforehand?
Yeah. Did he get away with it before he got caught? Ugh. And was he the only guy selling information? I certainly doubt it.
Yeah, probably not.
And, you know, with these organizations, you have to continually justify the reason that you're getting so much money from the public, I guess, tax dollars and all of that, mm-hmm. with any intelligence community or organization. And as the Cold War came to an end, they switched gears again because there were terrorist threats coming from Northern Ireland, states such as Libya, where Colonel Gaddafi was operating, and that was a threat, at least at the time, a perceived threat. These were some of the major threats, at least according to the MI5, for a little while there. And then, you know, like we said, the Cold War is coming to an end. Now we're in the 90s and there were some major reforms put into place. And the service actually, around this time, gained its first female director general.
Yeah, Dame Stella Remington, who held the position from 1992 to 1996.
And then the rise of Islamist terrorism at the end of the 90s, culminating in the 9/11 attacks in 2001, led to massive changes in the way MI5 operated.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, Folks, it's no secret that counterintelligence is a murky, murky business. Operations often edge into morally and legally gray areas. Over the course of its existence, like many other intelligence agencies, MI5 has conducted numerous secret operations, often without any public oversight and often even without governmental oversight. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
And many people would say that is the way it should be.
Sure, sure. Sometimes even people who don't work for MI5, mostly people who work for MI5 probably say that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I see the point about compartmentalized information, right? There's a need to have that sort of operational security. But critics don't buy this. Critics allege that MI5 is much more than a counterintelligence agency. In fact, they argue while MI5 functions as a spy service, it also effectively functions as a criminal empire.
Whoa.
Yeah, like Hydra level. Well, what the hell are we talking about? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy.
While the MI5 might not be a criminal organization, at least to its parent government, let's just call it, what do we call it? The Parliamentary United Kingdom and their government. And, you know, perhaps the Queen and all of her subjects. But it certainly functions as a criminal organization, at least at times. And we're not, again, we're not just throwing ninja stars. Is that okay to say? We're not just throwing ninja stars at Britain. We've seen this occur, as we said earlier, with many other intelligence services within many other countries. But it does function as a criminal organization sometimes.
And we know this. This isn't a theory.
No.
This isn't some tinfoil internet bloggery here. It turns out that in 2018, declassified documents showed that the government of the United Kingdom allows MI5's agents and informants to carry out crime within the UK without consequence. They've been allowed to do this for at least 30 years.
Whoa.
Seriously, it's a license to kill. It's a license to torture, pillage.
Did you just say a license to kill?
Yes. Oh, wait. Yeah, I did.
I mean, come on, man.
That's great. I can't believe I didn't think of that. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that.
But really.
The bit we did was awesome. But the fact that they can just go murder people is not cool.
And as it turns out, which was a bummer to me or to my kid self, they don't actually have a license they can flash before they kill someone, letting them know that it's legit.
Right.
It's more of an expression.
Maybe we should just manufacture our own. Not to use, but just to have.
Just on a t-shirt maybe?
Like, how would you feel if you stole someone's wallet and you were going through the wallet and you found like three different fake forms of identification, right? All the same face, three different names, three different profiles. And then you saw like this mysterious license to kill. What would you do with that wallet?
I would put it right back down, I'd wipe my prints from it.
There you go.
Place it right back down on the ground.
Clever, clever. All right. Well, I know what you guys are getting for the holidays.
You'd also have to check local security cameras and any CCTV that's around to make sure to destroy those tapes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay.
And you probably want to drop your phone too, because that GPS record would be there.
Oh, God.
You know what? We might be taking this thought experiment a little too far right now. If you do have a license to kill and you can tell us about it without killing us, we would love to hear your experiences. We will do our best to keep you anonymous. Just putting it out there. But I guess you're right, Noel. It's, as we'll see, they kind of did have not a badge they could wave around, but they did have documented proof that the government at all levels that were aware of it approved of this. It was called a secret and concealed policy. This would allow the security service to authorize participation in murder, torture, sexual assault, or other grave criminality if just a few folks believed it was in the service of the greater good, in the public interest.
That is so creepy and disgusting, and I wonder how many other intelligence organizations have an active policy like that, a secret and concealed policy. Okay, so this was basically a criminal authorization, just literally that. You can do crime, and it's okay.
But it's like a for the greater good clause, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the implication here.
Yeah, but yes, but this is something that has been around for 30 years, and it was only first acknowledged in a British court when an alliance of human rights groups argued that it was unlawful to have this kind of policy. Like, nah, maybe not. Let's not do this.
Mm-hmm. And it was completely secret. Like, they were practicing omerta until 2012. Prime Minister David Cameron wrote to Sir Mark Waller, the intelligence service commissioner at the time, asking him to keep the policy under review, which is, we've got a quote. It's very British in the way it's written, but we'll give it a shot.
I'm going to do a British accent. Let's see. In the discharge of their function to protect national security, the Security Service has long-standing policy for their agent handlers to agree to agents participating in crime in circumstances where it is considered such involvement is necessary and proportionate in providing or maintaining access to intelligence that will allow the disruption of more serious crimes or threats to national security.
Oh! Wow, that was great.
When
first
you say
of all,
it like that, it sounds nice.
But
it sounds like he's describing marzipan.
Sounds like he's reading like a Winnie the Pooh story or something, you know?
It's totally it's a clause for undercover agents, right? That's what that is.
Well,
no, but I mean
that part is. but yeah, it's saying like if you have an informant,
yes,
who is operating maybe in something like gun running or human trafficking circles,
yeah,
and you need to keep them embedded.
Question,
then let them
go. In the States,
yeah,
you see it in movies. I'm just wanting to see what you guys think about this. Whenever an undercover agent is offered drugs, they go to whatever lengths they can to not actually do the drugs. If they're like, you know, like prove you're not a cop, do the drugs or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like, oops, I dropped the drugs. You know, isn't that a thing? I'm wondering. Like, do you think we have a? It does seem like it's not. It's frowned upon for undercover cops to like get deep and start like doing drugs. Seems like there's a border.
Yeah.
There's a boundary that we would prefer not to cross.
They probably want to avoid it, but it comes into that idea of the greater good, right? Accomplishing the sting or the operation. So I am sure there are people who have maybe in the DEA or something been forced to do cocaine or something like that. But I don't know if there's a strict bright line policy-wise.
I don't think there can be.
Yeah.
I think because all of it's circumstantial, right? Especially when you're dealing with this. If this is full-on national security for the past 30 years, I can't even imagine some of the terrible things that some of these agents have had to do, like you're saying, in the human trafficking fields, in drug fields, in murder, yeah, in order to then get a bigger fish essentially down the line.
And you also have to wonder, okay, let's put ourselves in that hypothetical position. Let's say Paul Mission Control Deccant is a big time, like narcos level Colombian drug cartel leader, right?
I can see it. Okay.
And we're up and comers who are going to be lieutenants. And he's like, do this cocaine in front of me. It's cocaine. And we would look very suspicious if we just fumbled.
Just dropped it.
Because I don't know a ton about that drug, but I do know about the general trends of addiction, and people who are into that kind of stuff don't just drop it.
Yeah. In that case, I think the fumble move would be to accidentally drop it on one of the guys that you know is not an undercover agent so that it's, oh, well, we didn't waste it. It just is all over that guy now.
I don't know, man. I think you have to do it if you're at that point. I
mean, it's like that. It can't be like that scene in that Woody Allen movie where he sneezes the cocaine off the dish or whatever, and it's just basically like a party foul. It's more like you're going to get shot in the face foul. You know?
Yeah. But then if you're talking about the bigger operations where you're actually out in the field doing things other than drugs, the actual criminal acts, that's where it gets a little, I don't know, it gets murky for me.
Right. Like if you are embedded as an enforcer and you're sent to beat the crap out of someone, you know what I mean? And I'm sure there have been in the past undercover agents who have to performatively beat the snot out of one another just to make sure they look like they're legit. So yes, the informant stuff, That's part of it. And that doesn't seem that far out. But when Cameron is writing this letter to Sir Mark Waller, he essentially says, look, we're not going to ask you to tell us whether – like we don't want you to feel as if you have to report it to anybody, if you get what I'm saying. Anyone. And you don't have to worry about whether or not it's legal at all.
That's just crazy, man.
Is that one of those things where it sort of exists in like an extra legal gray area?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And most people in the government had no idea what was happening. You know what I mean? I think most people in Parliament at that time would have said, you know, we should not give people these licenses for wanton destruction. Cameron, to be fair, I am going to try to be fair here, said he had considered making the letter public in the interest of transparency, but decided against it because he thought it might be damaging to the national interest, also known as his political career.
Wow.
That's what I think. I think he was saying damaging to the national interest, but he meant damaging to his political career.
Yeah.
Kind of a typo, maybe a little –
I can see that. I can see that, Ben. I mean, I can see where you become prime minister, you get whiff of something like this, and as a citizen, it gives you pause just knowing that it's happening, right? No matter what your beliefs are in while you're holding that office. And it does seem like he kind of rode the fence there a little bit of should I, shouldn't I tell anybody about this? This is really effed up. But let's keep national security and public interest in order and let's just balance it out and say, let's just keep it quiet. Like, wasn't it the whole idea that he basically just, he told this guy not to comment on the legality? That was the whole idea?
Yeah. So it's the policy is under review, doing air quotes here. I hope you can hear them. The policy is under review. However, what that essentially means is, provide cover for us and don't like, okay, look, sometimes you gotta break a few innocent eggs if you really want to cook a terrorism omelet. You know what I mean?
Jeez.
So that's exactly what happened. So don't comment on the legality. Don't refer it to any prosecuting body. Don't refer it to law enforcement. Let's keep this between us. Let's have a greater good. So the argument was essentially that for most of history, most of modern British history, they have been following one of two paths as just a nation. There was the rule of law and then there were criminal acts, right? But they called this strategy the third direction.
Great boy band.
right. Do you guys remember Glee? Do you remember their band, One Direction? Wait, what was
One
it?
One Direction was a real band. Yeah.
What am I thinking of?
Well, there was that U plus me equals us thing.
Yeah.
With the fake
new
boy band.
New Direction.
Maybe. New Direction?
New Direction. It's a pun.
New Direction. I see. Yeah. I get it.
Very, I know.
Very bawdy.
Like Boy's Soul from Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Right.
But they called this thing, seriously, the third direction. Nobody acknowledged it until this year. In a British court, when that alliance of human rights groups that Matt mentioned earlier, Privacy International, who are the other ones?
Yeah, those guys over at PI. Then we've got Reprieve, the Committee on the Administration of Justice, and the Pat Finucane Center.
According to the legal team representing this alliance, the third direction policy is likely to have enabled the security service to conceal wide-ranging illegal activity, and they brought this case before an investigatory powers tribunal. The trial included, as a bonus, the publication of a heavily redacted document, a guideline essentially for how to break the law and get away with it. This is how you do it. And like a lot of government documents, you can find copies of this published in a couple of different places in British media, but tons, like the entire paragraphs are blacked out. They're not going to admit this stuff, right?
No.
Because it's still the great boogeyman of national security.
Exactly. And you know, the timing of the letter was also really strange here because just 2 weeks after this highly redacted document gets released, it's made public, Mr. Cameron, our buddy, admitted that there was this thing called state collusion in the 1989 murder of Belfast solicitor Patrick Finnegan. And state collusion? What does that mean?
That means essentially the Cameron is arguing some faction of the intelligence apparatus or the state apparatus of the United Kingdom may have aided in this guy's death, or may have at the very least been criminally negligent in protecting him, right?
There you
That's
go.
That's the most fair way to say it. They got into some very, very, very dirty things when they were attempting to retain Northern Ireland, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And we'll tell you more about the trial after a word from our sponsor. So according to Sir James Edie QC, that stands for Queen's Counsel. Those are the guys who have the wigs. The name for those wigs is peruke, right? So
peruke assault.
What was the one you did off air?
Peruke's on fire.
Peruke.
If you want to learn more about the history of the peruke, you can check out me and Ben's other podcast, Ridiculous History, where we do an episode about what the heck's up with those crazy British lawyer wigs.
Which awesome.
Which is one of our first episodes. So be kind or be brutal. It's up to you. We just want you to know that's a great word.
The internet's going to do what the internet's going to do, Ben.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. So this guy, Sir James Edie, QC, is representing the intelligence agencies, the Home Office and the Foreign Office, and he told this Investigatory Powers Tribunal that details of MI5's conduct had to be kept secret, even in the modern day, and could not be aired in open court. He argued that the claim should be restricted to investigating over a sensible time period, at most 6 years.
Wow, 6 years to keep all your secrets.
Right.
Interesting. Right.
So what did the Alliance of Human Rights Organizations say to that?
So in their argument, the claimants cite Finnegan's murder as an illustration of the considerable public importance of the issues raised. It also refers to allegations that Freddie Scapatici
– great name.
Yeah, it's pretty good – was a former senior member of the IRA and a security service agent working under the code name – oh, my God, I love this – Steak knife, but it's spelled S-T-A-K-E. That's a good DJ name right there, DJ Steak Knife. How about that, huh?
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, that's so Scapatici, a.k.a. Steak Knife, was, we have to say allegedly still, but was involved in kidnap, torture, and murder while working as an agent employed by MI5. So in a roundabout way, the government of the United Kingdom was paying this guy to kidnap, torture, and murder people.
For the greater good.
For the greater good, right. MI5 has refused to answer the claimant's questions about the scope of this third direction policy, including whether it could in principle authorize murder, torture, inhumane and degrading treatment, sexual assault, kidnapping, or false imprisonment. The security services lawyers also said to answer such questions would reveal the facts of conduct that they wish to keep secret. So it's kind of like a trust us, we're doing the right thing, we can't tell you what we're doing, we can't tell you why other than that. Not a very convincing argument.
No, not at all. And we also have other examples of some strange things that ended up coming to light, or at least things that maybe never wanted to see the light of day. There were some papers released by the Irish state that showed that there was this loyalist paramilitary group, or at least members of one of these groups, specifically the Ulster Volunteer Force. They're a paramilitary group out of Northern Ireland. They claimed that MI5 asked them to assassinate the then Prime Minister of Ireland, Charles Haughey, in 1985. And we went to this BBC source to learn a little bit more about this, but it's very, it's very strange because it was a letter, just kind of your standard letter sent to somebody like a correspondence, and it just happened to include a couple documents and a couple literally guys who just said, hey, by the way, MI5 asked us to kill you one time.
We didn't do it.
Yeah.
But you know, you should know.
It's crazy. It was sent 2 years after the alleged, assassination or the hit was put on him, mm-hmm. I guess. Mm-hmm. It contained a long list of collusion allegations against the British Intelligence Service, or various services that the British Intelligence has. This guy, it was addressed to Mr. Haughey, and it read, "In 1985, we were approached by an MI5 officer. He asked us to execute you." And it said that this paramilitary group had been supplied with, quote, "details that would have compromised this guy's personal security, including aerial photographs of his family home, his cars, and his private yacht."
So for an imperfect comparison, it's similar to, say, the CIA taking over Newfoundland and the people of Newfoundland wanting to make a united Canada. And so the CIA contacts someone in Canada and says, kill whomever is in charge of this unity group in Newfoundland, or kill the prime minister of Canada so we can keep our part.
Yeah. And I guess they didn't imagine that the people who were not necessarily the friends of the British Intelligence Service, they wouldn't just say, oh, yeah, okay, sure, boss.
Well, maybe they just said, you know, killing prime ministers a step too far.
I guess that's what I'm saying. Yeah, like they didn't expect that to occur. Mm-hmm. That seems very strange to me.
In 2010, Binyam Mohammed al-Habashi went to court to hold MI5 accountable for collusion in his torture at the hands of Uncle Sam. And then there's the example of Shakir Amir, who said MI5 watched him being tortured in 2001.
That was really brutal too.
Yeah.
Guy, he was in Guantanamo Bay, right? Mm-hmm. And he said like several times British officers would be in the room while he's being beaten, just brutally beaten, his head slammed against the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty crazy stuff.
It's truly disturbing because now with all this new information, this admission on the part of the British government that these sorts of things occur, many of those previous allegations of criminal activity on the part of MI5 that were once dismissed as out-and-out conspiracy theories seem increasingly maybe not plausible, maybe not probable, but certainly less impossible. They've been implicated in the murder of anti-nuclear activist Hilda Merle. They've been accused of creating a far-right neo-Nazi group, Combat 18. Their profile peaked in February 15th, 1995, when they orchestrated a riot in Dublin that led to a cancellation of a football match between England and Ireland. One theory suggests that British intelligence wanted to create a magnet for the most extreme parts of these political parties. One member who was convicted of murder in 1998, a guy named Charlie Sargent, has been accused of being an MI5 informant with some pretty solid evidence. And then we did the death of Commander Buster Crabbe in a previous episode.
So yeah.
Buster Crabbe. Mm-hmm.
Where he never surfaced, and it seems that maybe someone on the inside was responsible.
Weren't there frogmen involved in that story?
Yes.
Yeah. What about crabmen?
They never made it to Crabbe. Mainly because the difficulty of making forward-backward motion.
That's hard.
Yeah.
Scuttling.
So, Matt, you mentioned Colonel Muammar Gaddafi earlier as well, right?
Oh, yeah. And in 96, there was a bomb that was placed under a car that was, I guess, thought to be the vehicle that Gaddafi was going to be traveling in his motorcade. But, he wasn't in that vehicle. The car did explode. The bomb did explode. And several bodyguards were killed. There was an ensuing gun battle that killed several people. And there were even there would be assassins, you know, the people that planted the bomb and everything. They had links to Al-Qaeda. And it's thought that maybe MI5 had a little bit of a hand in this.
Right. The head of the Libyan desk for MI5 at the time was a guy named David Shaler. And in 1997, he left the service, leaked this information or these accusations, these allegations to the press. He was forced to flee to France. And in 1998, he claimed that the plot to kill Gaddafi had been funded by MI6.
Wow. In
cooperation with MI5. There's,
you know, taking out a leader like that of a country is no small deal.
Well, and there's compelling, it's not compelling evidence. There's proof that ultimately the French government was behind the assassination of Gaddafi to preserve financial hegemony because they wanted, you know, Gaddafi did many, many terrible things. But the thing France was most frightened of him doing was to create a continental African currency, a dinar.
So, yep.
So mess with the money, right? That's what happens.
Money in the oil.
The new series starring Matt Frederick.
There's always money in the banana stand.
So what does this all mean? This is pretty strange because it's rare for this kind of information to come out in such a blatant way.
Yeah.
Break the law for the greater good. Most intelligence agencies, I would say, practice that, right? The problem is the goalpost of that defines greater good is always moving.
Who's good?
Right.
Greater for whom?
Exactly. Exactly. And at this point, many of us listening to the show today will have a hard time being surprised. Some of us might even support this policy. You know what I mean? There are people who say that torture is a terrible thing, but ultimately it saves lives. We have an episode on why that is not true.
We do. As well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there are points to be made that if you – it's not an easy task to stop the, you know, in your worldview, the worst people in the world from doing the worst things. It's not an easy task to prevent that from happening. And you do have to – perhaps do some bad things. It's just, I think in this case, it's that gray area of how bad is too bad for a thing for the good guys to do to prevent the bad guys.
Well, it's that idea, right? That to like counter the bad guys, you got to stoop to their level on some, you got to play by their rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to get stepped all over, right? In theory.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a good point. Did I tell you guys I rewatched True Detective?
Ooh.
Recently.
Season 2?
Season 1.
Well,
thank God.
Yeah.
No, I have a friend that really says revisit season 2, give it another chance.
I've heard that before, but I need to take a break. Season 1 was just so great. There's a quote that's not a spoiler, but this conversation reminds me of it. The two main characters, Marty and Rust, are having a philosophical discussion about the nature of good and evil. And at some point in the conversation, Marty asks if they're good people, and Russ says, no, we're bad, but they need bad men like us to keep the others from the door.
Yeah.
And
that bear from the beginning of the show. Remember?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Or Jack Nicholson, right? Not as a character, just him.
He's a creepy looking guy.
I wouldn't want
him knocking.
Yeah, I don't know him well enough to remark on his door policy.
I guess the big question is, do we have to have the bad guys inside the door keeping the other bad guys from the door? Why can't we just build a giant wall and keep everybody out?
That's very, very, very topical. Topical question. Ooh, you got there.
Hot takes. So,
hot takes with Matt.
Totally kidding. I'm totally
Well,
totally
it's a
kidding.
Good question, though, because should MI5 allow its agents and informants to break the law? Does it really become a necessary evil on the way to achieving a greater good, right? And if so, for whom? What laws do they break? How do we measure the success or the efficiency of something like this if it's conducted entirely in secret? What sort of oversight should the public and or government agencies have on this process? Because right now, the answer is none. They have none.
Yeah.
They have a letter from 2012 that's like, don't send this to anybody. Basically, David Cameron sent a no snitching letter.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And that's where we are today. No snitching, boys and girls.
Snitches end up in stitches.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what you think. Find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and let us know, are these things necessary evils? Is allowing the collapse of the rule of law in one scenario really necessary to allow the enforcement of rule of law in another situation, right? That's ultimately the question.
It really is.
And by the way, I was just going to bring this up before we ended. At the Tenderfoot holiday party thing that we were at, mm-hmm. the three of us, I ran into a gentleman. Paul Deccan was there too. But we ran into a gentleman who truly, truly believes and had a long discussion with me about it that the British government still controls the United States.
I overheard that and I didn't want to jump in.
He truly believed it.
Oh, I should have talked to him.
I know. Well, I didn't want to go any deeper than we already had in the conversation because it's one of those that doesn't really go anywhere after you hit a certain wall. It's like, yeah, well, we can't prove anything, but that's an interesting idea.
Did you tell him we did an episode on it?
I did.
Did you tell him that he can contact us via a telephone call? We're just a phone call away?
I did. I said call 1-833-STDWYTK. Brought the STD back for this one because it's not about awful things like the last one.
And I also want to just – in the interest of full transparency, I'm not at death's door, but I am darn sure on like the sub basement of sickness right now. So that's why my voice sounds a little bad. If you heard any mucusy noises, sorry folks, that was me. Should be hale and hearty later.
Are you down with the sickness, Ben?
Oh,
ooh, ah.
I'm always up to something.
It's just extra deep. I like it.
I know, it's nice and gravelly.
Thanks, guys.
Paul will surely snip out all the snot sounds.
Thanks, Paul. Let us know what you think and check in with your fellow listeners. We'd like to take this debate to the internet. We mentioned it earlier in the show, but you can find us at our Facebook site. Here's where it gets crazy. If you love all that, but you don't want to do any of it, whatever your reasons may be, we have some good news for you. You can write to us directly. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.